Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, everyone. If you live in or near Belfast, I've got a very exciting event to tell you all about. On Friday, the 11th of April at the Ulster Museum, I'll be speaking at a brilliant free speech union event organised as part of their Belfast Speakeasy. The topic is the rise of the speech police, the police's apparent obsession of arresting people over spicy memes, even as they allow burglaries to go unpunished. It's such an important topic, and I'll be speaking alongside the great Harry Miller from Fair Cop and Jenny Holland, a beloved Spiked contributor. To find out more and to get your tickets, go to freespeechunion.org, that's freespeechunion.org, and click on the events tab. Or you can click on the link in the description. See you there. Hello and welcome back to the Spiked podcast. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, filling in for Fraser Myers in the hot seat today. I'm delighted to be joined by two very special guests, Claire Fox, the director of the Academy of Ideas and a life peer in the House of Lords. How are you doing, Claire?
I'm very well, thank you.
And also delighted to be joined, first time on the show, by Josh Howie, presenter of Free Speech Nation over at GB News. How are you doing, Josh?
Very good, thanks.
So we've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to talk about 7th of October and those who would seek to deny it, the corruption of statistics around sex and gender, and the whole discussion about adolescents, Andrew Tate, and young men that have been bubbling up again recently. Claire, let's start with October the 7th, because I know that you are a member of a parliamentary commission which has just published a landmark report chaired by Lord Roberts, cataloguing the horrors of October the 7th, 2023, in horrific but quite important, I think, detail, what actually took place when Hamas staged that pogrom in southern Israel. Do you want to tell us a bit about this report and why yourselves and Lord Roberts felt moved to put this down on paper?
Yeah, I mean, I can't... I was there at the beginning when it was decided to do this, to commission this work, but I can't take any credit. But I've been a witness to the testimonies a number of times that have come, that have been happening in Parliament. And I mean, just to sort of show people, I mean, it's a really substantial document, this. And if you think about what prompted it, it was recognising quite quickly that there was going to be a denial of the events of October the 7th. You know, even, you know, as all the footage came out, as the testimonies of the survivors came out, as people started to talk about it, there were other people saying, well, I don't know, where's your evidence? Where's your evidence? So we kind of didn't have long to wait for a kind of new version of Holocaust denial in a way. And so it became a, well maybe we should contribute to a kind of gathering of evidence. It's meticulously done. I mean, I did spend a lot of time kind of gripping chairs and kind of not wanting to listen as people gave us the evidence. And we did cross-examine, but, you know, ask people things. And that included people who were, I mean, obviously they were survivors, but they might have been people who were identifying bodies, or they might have been people who were working nearby and saw certain things. It was a wide range of people, and I the only thing I really wanted to share, because I really recommend that people read it, it's online, it's going to be an important historic document. It's the thing that's really consistently got to me on this whole question, is that it's become a numbers game. You know, it's how many Palestinian children, how many Palestinian men and women, And the original events of October the 7th have sort of drowned out in the huge numbers, and there are substantial numbers of people who've been killed in the subsequent war. And what this whole experience brought home to me was the qualitatively different nature of the violence. And when I first spoke about it in the Lords, I referred to, you know, those people who were called the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And I accidentally saw and then read a testimony at the time of them hacking off heads. This wasn't, and nobody at the time sort of said, oh, there's only one or two. What's your problem? You know what I mean? It's like sort of, you knew that this was something else. This was a kind of act of barbarity that was had civilizational consequences in a way. And I think that's what October the 7th was like for me, which is it wasn't simply the numbers. It was the driving force of hatred mm-hmm. of Jews and so on and so forth that had been well discussed. Every time we were there as witnesses, we really got that. And it in very cold, dispassionate testimonials, that is what you feel. It's absolutely disconcerting.
And on that point, Josh, about the denialism, that's one of the things which is so sickening but also striking about the whole post-October the 7th discussion, which is this was the most well-documented terror attack pogrom in history. I mean, the amount of GoPro footage alone that the Hamas murderers themselves were streaming onto the internet should surely have put to bed any kind of claims that this was just a kind of military incursion or that this was being exaggerated or that any claims about sexual violence or the cold-blooded murder of children and so on is just being made up. How could people, you know, how do you get your head around that denialism in the face of so much obvious, irrefutable evidence?
Well, it's interesting when Claire says civilizational consequences, that I think that is actually what applies more, because that act of barbarity almost exists outside of what we've seen over here. And mm-hmm. the civilizational consequences is this denial of truth, this denial of that barbarity is almost, that's what has consequences arguably for this society that we live in. Because, I mean, I'm sure obviously there are reports in Israel into what happened, but the difference over there is it's a very small country. Everybody know somebody who was either kidnapped or murdered or was there on the mm-hmm. day, and they have the eyewitnesses and the conversations between each other. For us over here, it's very difficult. I think it's difficult for anybody to really digest that barbarity and that violence, because it seems like it's something that belongs in the cinema or some mm-hmm. horror film, whatever. And so I think there's partly just the squeamishness of us as human beings thinking that we live in a very sort of protected moral society, mm-hmm. which just and we don't want to think that that's how close we are to hell mm-hmm. in a weird way. Yeah. We don't want to deal with that.
I think as well, because I've emphasized, I suppose, what got me. But what's very important about documents like this is, you know, it's the meticulous nature of the planning that went into this.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's detailed maps of who was where, when, what happened at what time. I mean, it's actually, in that sense, it's a document of historic importance, not because it tells heartrending stories that, in a way, can just become heartrending stories. I simply wanted to emphasise the nature of the violence was something else. And as you've picked me up on this, Josh, but you're right, which is, I thought everybody would see that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you actually talk to people and they say, well, you know, there's those people, but what about these people? And you think, oh, no, have you not? There's a war, that's that thing, and there's this. But anyway, when you recognise that this was a consciously orchestrated attempt at an invasion of Israel for particular reasons as part of an ongoing jihadist assault on removing Jews from the region, then you think, oh,
mm-hmm.
and this is evidenced.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other hard thing for people to understand is, and I think that's probably just that covers the entire region or mm-hmm. a Western discourse of that region, is we, through solipsistic means, we kind of apply our morality to Hamas and the people who partook in this attack. So you're kind of thinking, oh, well, we try and put our own moral values. Well, they're doing it because they want freedom, or they're doing it to resistance or decolonization, whatever it is, whatever excuse you want to call it, where they, but people can't grapple with the fact that, no, it was religious violence is what drove them. And when you watch the videos, it's people shouting the Allahu Akbar and reveling in the barbarity because they believe that they are, that's what's going to send them to heaven. And that seems to be the bit that's lost mm-hmm. so much of it when you're trying to talk about it, is we can't apply our kind of our morality of what a war is or what resistance looks like. We sort mm-hmm. of think it's going to be, you know, if the Germans invaded and we were sort of all hiding in barns and then we would come out and together and dispatch the mm-hmm. Nazi patrol or whatever it is, these ideas, it's a totally different thing. It's a religious war mm-hmm. for them. And that's a hard thing to understand, because if you're not religious, certainly in that way, then you can't put yourself, empathize with their position at mm-hmm. all.
And it's so abundantly clear that what fueled and turbocharged the horrific, almost like apocalyptic level kind of violence and depravity of that particular day is also what turbocharged the denialism, obviously. I mean, it's the fact that the reason that there is such thing as Holocaust denial, and it's something that, you know, always kind of raises its ugly head on various different sections of politics from one time and another, and also the fact that we did see almost instantly this kind of new form of Holocaust denial in live form on social media in the wake of October the 7th, really speaks to the core kind of anti-Semitic component of this, Claire, something which, you know, even when confronted with a scale of Jewish Israeli suffering on such a impossible to kind of grasp level, people still felt the need to deny it. They still almost couldn't accept that Jews would be victims, even if their children, elderly Holocaust deniers and so on. I mean, should this really be a wake-up call, you know, about our own societies and the willingness of people to believe these kinds of denialist anti-Semitic myths about this conflict?
I mean, absolutely. I think it has been a wake-up call in many ways, but we three can notice that not enough people have woken up. And so that's disconcerting. I think what we've got is the normalization of that combination, which Spiked have been so brilliant at documenting, I have to say, of this is what decolonization looks like. Woke, I hate that phrase, but, you know, that side to it, with then the religious in the sense that, you know, the ideological politicization of a religion around Islamism, as expressed by the people who actually perpetrated the crimes on October the 7th, and their supporters and hangers-on over in different European countries. And what, of course, has been disconcerting is that when that open support, Hamas cheerleaders, is happening over here, the sadly progressive left, the identitarian left, have said, well, it's understandable.
Yeah.
I mean, after all they've been through. So October the 7th is now treated like a border skirmish. Mm. You know, well, these things happen, don't they? And that is something which has to be changed. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth fighting for, that October the 7th is not just part of an ongoing conflict in the region. And that's why I suppose this document's important.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
And the consequences of it, Josh, continue to be felt over here. I mean, not only in the immediate aftermath of October the 7th did we see those celebratory displays in the streets. You know, it's before that the war in Gaza even had begun, that you saw people taking to the streets to essentially celebrate the pogrom. There was, according to the Community Security Trust, a 96% spike in anti-Semitic assaults. We're not even just talking about other forms of hate crime or people saying things on the internet, actual violence as a consequence of people's Jew hatred. And then most recently, we saw this horrific story in Wales where this London-based Israeli music producer essentially got lured to this cottage under false pretenses and kidnapped by three young men who claimed that they were doing so partly to extort him, but also out of belief in jihad and clear-cut anti-Semitism and this kind of jihadist, thuggish worldview that they had. I mean, why are people ignoring the evidence of their own eyes, even in their own country, let alone in the Middle East?
I think people's identities are too much wrapped into, and their morality is like Israel and Jews, / Jews are bad, and the Palestinians and the Gazans, Hamas, and that is all that they... To accept any collateral damage, any anti-Semitism as in this example, would be to kind of be drawn deeper into the truth of what's actually going on. So I don't think, and it goes back to this kind of this victim status where you actually in this case have a Jewish Israeli victim kidnapped by three whether they were jihadists or not, but Muslim men who were using the language of jihad and Allah to partly justify their actions. And they kind of appeared in the press after they were sentenced and has just disappeared as quickly. And it just seems craziness. I was reading a thing about it today, and the details of it and how the meticulousness of it and how much this person being a Jew was connected to it and they're being Muslims. And it's like, it just, why is this not a big story? Why are we not looking at this as a kind of like, this is an example of where a year and a half of this hateful rhetoric and denial of truth is taking us, where not only can a Jewish guy be kidnapped, and you know, they were saying they were going to murder him or get his money, or they were going to murder him one way or the other and hold him accountable for being a Jew as well. And not only that, is that element of things, but then once it's kind of part of the public domain, it's just instantly disappears.
Yeah.
It drops beneath the waves. And
has no political consequences, no broader cultural discussion is stirred up by it. And you do think if some of the characters were different, if this didn't involve a Jewish Israeli, frankly, that this would be the kind of thing that would spark some kind of reckoning of some description, you know, especially with all the things that have preceded it over the past 18 months. There's a lot more that we need to cover. But Claire, is there anything you want to add?
Well, only very quickly, which is that I think it's got worse than when we used to, those of us who have been following this noticed that there was a kind of, you know, don't look back in anger, attempt at kind of minimizing the kind of jihadism that and the rise potentially of Islamism. I think that there's an awareness of it, particularly, by the way, because something which I don't want us to forget what happened during the general election, which is that the democratic process was almost thrown by the terrorizing of candidates because they wouldn't say what activists demanded they say in relation to calling for a ceasefire and people having their offices daubed with red paint and election. I mean, this is democratic process. This is like weird. And it was so shocking that the government actually said, this is so shocking, we're having an investigation into it. Anyway, it's all gone very quiet, as they say. We haven't heard from it since. And I just think that what's now happening is that there's this generalisation of a discussion about extremism. And these Swansea, this Swansea incident, which is they chained him to a radiator very much with a, you're like our hostage. You know what I mean? And they might have been incompetent, but all of the language they use, they might not have been part of an organised thing, but they are seeing themselves as venging, being avenging what Israel's doing. And the general discussion is, oh, there's an out-of-control youth problem.
Yeah.
And there's criminality and so on. Is to deny the specificity, and not helped by the fact that they obviously weren't being organised by Hamas or ISIS or anything.
No, it's almost how naturally that came together, which is one of the most chilling things. It didn't have to be an organisation. They were three people from different cities who met online and decided to do
that. So one more thing before we do move on. It's just tying on to that. It's just the inability of our leaders to, or any leaders, to really come forward and just state a moral truth. And Sadiq Khan was asked, I think it was just even today, like, do you think the river to the sea is an anti-Semitic statement or not? And he just totally fubbed it, and then he put it back on to we've done more than reform. There's no one, because there's this sort of playing both, seeming, there seems to be both sides. And I wouldn't even say one side is the side of Jews in this case. I would just say there's just one side is morality and good, and one side is sort of playing this kind of game with what they think Muslim voters want to hear. And until someone actually says, and it should have been through that political process, as through the election, and just saying, no, I'm sorry, Israel was invaded, they are fighting back, there is no genocide. And the politicians should have bravely just said those truths rather than trying to be like, just both sides it all the time. And that's why we're in this situation now. And of course, because the moment you kind of take that clear stand, it all falls apart, as we've seen with other ideological movements. The moment someone actually just goes, no, this is just total rubbish. Like if it's in terms of men's, you know, men and women's sports or something like that, it's like everybody tiptoes around and tries to make everyone happy. And there's 99.9% penises here and there or whatever. But the moment someone just says, just calls it out, or as Andrew Doyle always says, you know, the emperor's new clothes and all of that. The moment someone actually does it, and no one's done that for this particular thing. Like these are traditional baddies in whatever way you want to call it, this ideology. And no one is, none of our politicians are brave enough to do that.
Let's move on and talk about another report that came out this week, which was telling something that I think many people who have been looking at the gender issue for some time wouldn't have been surprised to hear, but it's been encouraging that it's gotten so much attention. This, Claire, is the Professor Alice Sullivan-led review, which was commissioned by the Conservatives, but is now just reported back, about official statistics, whether that be in relation to the criminal justice system or the healthcare system, what have you, and the way in which gender ideology and a kind of soft regime of self-ID effectively has corrupted so many different areas of official data collection because of the fact that people were able to essentially self-identify. That's what then would be recorded, even in relation to criminals. It'd be very easy for them to change their name and gender and therefore kind of slip through the net. The report points to loads of clear-cut consequences of this, people not being called forward for certain types of cancer screenings because they have their quote-unquote gender identity down on the records rather than their actual biological sex. But what, you know, within this report or what the, or the discussion around it has most struck you about this?
I think it's, well, first of all, it's really great that it's come out because Alice Sullivan is, you know, well-respected in this field, and it was very exciting when it was commissioned. And when the, after the general election, we had a Labour government, there was no way of knowing whether the report might disappear. And certainly a number of us have been asking in Parliament, you know, when's the Sullivan review coming out? Because you were worried that it might not, to their credit, it's come out. Also, to the credit of Wes Streeting, he at least has said this is important and he's going to make sure that it has an impact on health statistics. But I always feel that's a bit cheaty one. Because I just know that they'll say, oh, yes, we do need the data to be correct on this because we don't want to misdiagnose on cancer and so on and so forth. It's a little bit, there's a lot more to it than that because the main thing is that the collection of data is completely bonkers from any kind of level, that it depends which police force, which which is your preferred data preference, right? And so some of them have self-ID, some of them do have sex at birth, some of them do not. Oh, my God, it's all over the place. And then we get national crime statistics are meant to design policy. Even in then, if you think of anything, and this obviously was emerged in relation to the census, mm-hmm. but it matters in terms of us being able to have a serious discussion about, for example, victims of female or male violence, mm-hmm. if you see what I mean. You've got to know, well, were they men or are they men? There's very well documented cases where there's been media panics over the past. Radio 4 indulged in one where they said there was a big spike. This was some years ago. A big spike in women as sexual perpetrators.
Mm.
And the truth is, they then admitted that they didn't necessarily use the category woman in the sense of biological sex. So the problem then is that you can't know one way or another, because yeah. it might well be, by the way, that biological women are becoming perpetrators in terms of child abuse. Let's find out if that's significant. But of course, nobody knows that, and everyone suspects, because they backed off that story mm-hmm. because they said, oh, yes, the data might not be reliable. So what Alice Sullivan, Professor Sullivan, has done is, I think, invaluable, that it's gone through quite seriously all the different ways that we need reliable data and we're not getting it. And although I'm not keen on the notion of evidence-based policy, because I always think policy needs more than evidence, if we're going to have evidence, mm-hmm. can we make sure it's reliable? And to have to listen to all those politicians saying, this is evidence-based policy, then you say, how did you collect the data on sex and gender? And they go, there's always somebody raising the culture wars issue. You want to politicize. you know, it's so frustrating. So I'm delighted.
You know, it comes back to that thing, just how this has become an argument over actually what actual reality is and whether or not that should be fudged for the sake of ideology or hurt feelings. Was there anything that struck you about this report and the write-up, Josh? There's so many crazy examples.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was the one that really stood out when I was reading it, like just blew my mind, was that someone, a baby woman, was allowed to change her baby's sex and went back to the GP and said, no, was raising the baby at like a few months old in a different sex, and went back to the GP and said, I want a different number, and to put him or her down as a different sex. And the GP did it, and social services weren't called, and this is child abuse. And I imagine the GP was either just utterly ignorant, which surprised me, or just was afraid, mm-hmm. But that was most likely to it, and went, oh, I don't want to kick up a fuss here, and this poor child, let's have some follow-up, let's find out what's happened to this poor kid. So that's the danger, just one of many dangers. But to see it, as you were saying, like, look, this is stuff people have been in these kind of arguments mm-hmm. for years, have sort of seen bit by bit, the NHS bit here, the police here, to have it all collated together is a good thing, to have it then put towards the public so they can mm-hmm. understand what's going on. And we have a data hole here of sort of a decade or so of you know, data does matter. It was a deliberate obfuscation by ideologues to deliberately mix up the word gender and sex. And now it's kind of like, when we look back in history, historians will look at this 10 years and won't be able to sort of make, not just like the madness of it, but just will actually look at figures and facts mm-hmm. and whatnot, and just will go, oh, well, that was that decade, so it's the lost decade of ideology.
There'll have to be big asterisks next to it. Yeah. Like they went mad for a period here. Yeah. Female penises, etc.
I think the sad thing is that so many people have had their careers and reputations mm-hmm. trashed because they asked these very sensible questions just about data. And so there has been cancellations, but there's, you know, obviously that was partly, you know, Joe Phoenix as a criminologist started off thinking about these things through that prism. Alice Sullivan herself, you know, has been called out, as it were, in attempts to discredit her. I just don't think it's quite over yet. It's a great relief that mm-hmm. we're here. But one of the things is the way that media codes carry on instructing newspapers, and I mean, it's just utterly bonkers where you have that situation where you can now have the correct data, but you're still told this woman has just gone round filming in toilets and so on and so forth. And you think, it's not a woman, it's a man. Mm-hmm. But they refuse to do it. So there's still this sense of being gaslit all the time. Yeah. And I think it's worth noting that at the heart of the system the civil service in Whitehall, in all of these places, these people actively pursued this policy of confusion around data, because they argued for evidence-based policy and then tried to distort what the evidence said.
And it's not just that, people being not just people not being held to account. It's that it's still going on. The government hasn't come out and said, oh, this is terrible, we're going to fix this. That's the other
thing. We have accepted the report, etc., etc. From bureaucrats.
They're not actually acknowledging.
It could disappear, this report.
Yeah. And it's so exactly. This stuff is still going to continue. So maybe it's another 10 years until they finally actually get on top of it.
Yeah. Hopefully they will at some point. Another thing that seems to be really energising political debate this week is the question of young men and what's gone wrong with them, in inverted commas. So this is a discussion which has really kind of centered on this new hit Netflix series, Adolescence, telling the story of a boy accused of stabbing a schoolgirl at school, based, I believe, on a horrendous stabbing that took place in South London not too long ago. And the as I understand it, I haven't seen it, I understand you do, Claire, so you'll have to fill us in on the details. But the series itself kind of touches on these issues that have been doing around for some time about the manosphere, these kind of online incel and misogynistic influences, and so on. Obviously, the two words that we can never escape, Andrew Tate, seem to constantly float around this particular discussion. Claire, what have you made of, well, tell us a bit about what you think what the series is like, but also the chatter that seems to surround it.
Yeah, I think it's very important we distinguish between those two things, because this is a brilliant drama, you know, on anyone's. Whichever way, as a work of art, fantastic acting. There's this one take filming, but it is, you know, incredibly impressive that anyone's gone through that. And it's insightful, it's perceptive. I don't know how they pulled it off. And there's kind of like an emotional wreck at the end of it. But having said that, it was also so human, and I understood things that I hadn't understood before. It's what art does, right? Mm-hmm. And it's this tragedy of a young boy, and it's not a question of giving the end away, but a young boy being accused of this terrible crime and the impact that has on his family, on his school, on everything. What does it all mean is what they ask. Now, one thing that's interesting about chatter around things is I don't even think the words Andrew Tate are in it. I mean, I don't have it right. I don't know. I think manosphere might appear once.
Yeah.
Incel definitely appears quite a bit. But it's the kind of revelation where kind of like the police officer who's got a son at the same school as the boy starts, you know, discovers what emojis stand for, you know, and it's like, oh. And the son, it's the son who says, Dad, you're making the right fool of yourself here. What you've got to do is look at his Insta page, and then you'll see that he's been. So it's slightly more complicated than the debate around it. One thing I've really objected to is that it's now being said that this should be sent into every school because it will help every, you know, and obviously you think, well, you didn't say that about that fantastic docudrama, but that drama about the grooming gangs. I mean, the actual drama of the three girls, I mean, that was the most, I mean, at the time that completely blew my mind, and they didn't recommend that we showed it in every school, and maybe we should have done. But on the other hand, I kind of think we shouldn't, because they're dramas and people can watch them. And so it's been turned into a political issue, and we can discuss that by both sides. That's what I was going to say. Because then now we've got people who are saying, don't watch it because it's propaganda that white boys are the problem. And this is based on a true story, which we're not sure if it is, by the way, of a terrible incident, murder. And he was black, so why isn't he black? It's like, oh, for God's sake, everybody. I didn't even think about what colour he was when I was watching it. That's not really what it's about. And by the way, it is also true that the majority of people who live in the UK are white. And so, therefore, you're allowed to have a drama with a white boy in it, and a white family, and it doesn't mean that it's saying that they're all... this is not a demonising in the way that people are implying. It's maybe what's happening where you don't quite know what your kid's doing in the bedroom. I know that we were thinking at some point about discussing lockdown this evening, and then we're not. Actually, one of the things that I thought when the parents at some point saying, we thought he was safe, like he was at home in his room. I thought, at least he's not a bad lad out with the, you know, scally going around. Obviously, what is he doing? Oh, getting radicalised, right? Or, you know, being influenced. I actually thought about lockdown. The state forced all those teenage kids into their room. They weren't even able to go to school. I mean, and so I know it sounds silly. It seems to me that there is not a straightforward message in this drama, which is one of the reasons why it's brilliant. And it makes you think about all sorts of things, not least, by the way, that the school scenes, which are absolutely stupendous, made me really rethink a lot about how we do education. So I think it's, I recommend it to everyone, and stop being ridiculous about saying, why is he white and why is he not black and why is this and all the rest of it. Everybody should depoliticize it. But on the other hand, watch it and have conversations with your mates and with your colleagues about what it implies.
Do you think you can watch it with teenagers? You think?
You've got about 18 children, haven't you? So this is obviously touching on your...
It's not graphic or anything. I mean, it might be hard because it's a bit like, oh, is that what you think?
I actually think you should.
I think you might learn something, and it's certainly the basis of a conversation.
Just finally, Josh, to kind of focus on some of the chatter around this. I mean, obviously, everyone can agree that some of these influencers that we're talking about, whether we want to name names or not, are, you know, horrendous, misogynistic, all of that should go without saying. But at the same time, do you think it's slightly reductive, this kind of idea that because there's a few idiots sounding off on the internet, airing horrendous views about women, that therefore, even teenagers who are impressionable, but the idea that's going to kind of, that you just connect Andrew Tate to a horrendous murder and that it's job done, as if you can kind of blame what culture that kids engage with or what influences they follow.
Politicians will do
things.
That because they want the simple answer that they then can just point at Amazon or whatever it is. You know, Tate is the symptom. He's not the cause of it. My kids, they are aware of him and they sort of, you know, they're smart and they can recognize, they can ironically appreciate it or not. And they all think it's a little bit naff now. And, but then you've got someone like Gareth Southgate going, oh, we need contemporary role models. Well, what, like footballers with date rape and getting money for kicking a ball around? What, is this what you're saying? Is that kind of, buying a sports car? Is this the kind? I mean, I know there are good footballers, but the point is you can point to anybody and go, really, that the worst of that particular culture or whatever, however you want to address it. So there is an issue in this country with boys. Forget just white boy. I mean, there are academic issues and in terms of outcomes and going to university and all that. But there is a masculine crisis in this country, of course, and that for me is partly down to 20 years of, you know, men are bad. Mm-hmm. That connects to it, this is that there's not. Actually, it ties down. It's not even just men are bad. It's like it's the denial of masculinity, because whilst we've had the denial of women being different from men, like this is what this movement, there was a sort of the feminists of the last 10, 15 years are like, men and women are the same. And that's been like the sort of mantra. And it's like, there's, if anything that comes out of it in the next few years is this willingness to hopefully to embrace that men and women are different and have, you can, obviously there's not, doesn't mean that a woman can't do this or a man can't do that. But the point is there has to be some acknowledgement now that there are differences and that those differences aren't something to necessarily be ashamed of.
But by the way, I slightly disagree with you, but I'm not going to launch into that, right?
That's a different
discussion. No, I know, but it's just this. Yeah. It's like slightly complicated. But anyway, one of the things that's interesting in the drama, by the way, is that there's actually a discussion about, is this a crisis of masculinity? And the lad says, oh God, you're asking me about masculinity and you're asking me about my dad, you stupid woman, because he's the welfare, or, you know, you're trying to misinterpret this. But I actually think, one of the things I want to think about myself is, I do think things are difficult at the moment. We are getting lots of nihilistic incidents of young people and, you know, behaving in ways that we haven't seen before. I don't think it's a moral panic, you know. I think, why are people wanting to kill? people, you know, and Axel Rudder Cabana is a good example, but there's been quite a number of them at the moment. And I do think that we have to have an honest approach. Of course, the politicians make me want to then say there's no problem at all, yeah, because they are now trying to ban phones in school. They're going to fine schools if they don't take phones away. They're going to use it as yet more online harms so that they can censor the web. They're going to now re-look at the Online Safety Bill, which is Act, which is already draconian, give Ofcom even more powers, and so on and so forth. And so rather than us having a mature discussion about if there's an issue, mm-hmm, and whether what are the reasons why there's young black kids killing young black kids with knife crime, but also not just confined to that, but yeah, that actually there's a broader seems to be alienation. I don't have the answer to that. Well, we're not going to find it by this over-politicised assault on young men and the crisis of masculinity. And, you know, when they say we need better role models, and I'm thinking, we're all meant to say Gareth Southgate's a saint, aren't we?
Yeah.
I just don't think he is. I mean, know what I mean? Like, I mean, the coverage at the moment is, have you read his speech? It will change everything. Don't be ridiculous.
Thank you so much for watching the Spiked podcast. We'll be back the same time next week. In the meantime, why not subscribe to Spike's YouTube channel and then click the bell so you're always alerted whenever there's some new content. Spiked is producing more videos than ever, from podcasts like this one to interviews to our series of polemics. You really, really don't want to miss out on it. Plus, to get your daily dose of Spiked, just go to spiked-online.com. That's our website at spiked-online.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.